Welcome to Vashon 250. As America observes its 250th birthday, Voice of Vashon and the Vashon Heritage Museum have partnered to create our own recognition of this important milestone. We are looking back at what has happened in America since its beginning and examining how, over time, it has influenced our life on Vashon Island. In this second quarter of 2026, we continue to look at several of the famous high points that ultimately led to the Revolutionary War. I'm John Flora, and I'm joined by my colleague, resident historian, Bruce Holman. Welcome back to Vashon 250 and Episode 27, The British Occupy Philadelphia. The Redcoats occupied Philadelphia from September 26, 1777 to June 1778, capturing the American capital, but gaining little strategic advantage. The occupation was part of the Philadelphia campaign led by British General William Howe, aimed at seizing the revolutionary capital where the Second Continental Congress convened and the Declaration of Independence had been adopted in 1776. Howe initially attempted to draw George Washington's Continental Army into battle in New Jersey, but failed. He then transported his forces by sea to the northern Chesapeake Bay in August 1777, landing about 50 miles from Philadelphia. The British advanced north toward the city, defeating Washington's forces at the Battle of Brandywine on September 11th, which allowed them to approach the city. Washington later attempted a counterattack at Germantown, but dense fog and strong British resistance forced a retreat, leaving Philadelphia under British control. The British formally entered the city, unopposed, on September 26th. Many patriots fled, while loyalists welcomed the occupation. Capture of the rebel capital did not bring the end to the rebellion as the British thought it would. In 18th century warfare, it was normal that the side who captured the opposing forces' capital city won the war. But the Revolutionary War would continue for six more years until 1783 because of the rebels' unconventional warfare tactics. British officers quartered in prominent homes, and a puppet government of local loyalists was established. However, wartime shortages caused suffering among residents who remained with food, clothing, and firewood scarce due to American supply blockades. The British also bombarded Fort Mifflin and Fort Mercer to secure supply lines to the city.
There were a number of strategic consequences to the occupation of Philadelphia. Although Howe captured the American capital, the occupation did not yield decisive strategic gains. His slow advance and focus on Philadelphia prevented him from supporting General John Burgoyne's campaign in New York, which ended in British defeat at Saratoga, which we discussed in our last episode, and encouraged French entry into the war. Howe resigned during the occupation and was replaced by General Sir Henry Clinton. The British eventually abandoned Philadelphia in June 1778, retreating to New York. The British occupation of Philadelphia was a symbolic victory, but strategically limited. It demonstrated the challenges of controlling revolutionary territory, highlighted the resilience of the Continental Army, and indirectly contributed to internationalizing the conflict by failing to support Burgoyne's northern campaign. It also led to Valley Forge, Washington trying to keep the British in Philadelphia and from expanding outside of there. And it also eventually, after the Battle of Saratoga, led to France entering the war.
And it did something else domestically. The British occupation and abandonment of Philadelphia also led to very difficult choices for the black residents of the city, both free and enslaved. In 1777 and 1778, it wasn't clear whether an American or a British victory would be more likely to lead to freedom and greater rights. On the one hand, Quaker and abolitionist sentiment in Philadelphia had been growing in the decade before the war. As masters freed those they enslaved, the free black population of the city grew. Enslaved people in Philadelphia might have hoped that an American victory would lead to yet more manumissions or even the outlawing of slavery. During the war, 35 black men served in the 2nd Pennsylvania Brigade of the Continental Army, and others served on American privateers. On the other hand, black men and women in Philadelphia quickly learned of Lord Dunmore's proclamation in November 1775, a proclamation that offered freedom to patriots enslaved people who joined the British forces. Although Dunmore was the royal governor of Virginia, news of his proclamation reached Philadelphia within a week. During the occupation, many Africans and African Americans seemed to have decided that the British actually offered better prospects than the Americans, and as a result served among them as soldiers, guides, and laborers.
It's an interesting aspect of enslaved people sort of being forced in this choice between joining the revolution and the potential of possible freedom, although a good part of the revolutionary colonies had slaves. You know, Vermont had outlawed it, but it was a sort of a devil's choice, if you will, between do I fight with these revolutionaries where I might get freedom, or do I fight with British, which after Lord Dunmore's proclamation, sort of guaranteed them freedom. And the problem with that, of course, and we'll talk about this in a later episode, what's called the Book of Negroes in New York City actually kept track of all those African-American formerly enslaved people who worked with the British and had the promise of freedom. And yet when the war was over and the British left, they were forced to leave with the British. Many went to Newfoundland and of course, found it very inhospitable, found that they didn't really have total freedom, and so were left basically as refugees of war. So it's a very complicated sort of sense of where these people were in a decision that neither side really guaranteed them freedom.
So if we look at the whole idea of occupation in the United States, Nancy, let's talk about that. We haven't been occupied very much.
Well, that's exactly right. And it's one of the things I think that is exceptional about the United States, which is because first we stayed out of foreign affairs, and then when we were in them, we entered, you know, relatively strongly in the 20th century. So in general, this is not a country that is used to being occupied. This story of the revolution is quite unique in a sense.
And it's also an aspect of Fortress America. Right. I mean, we have two great bodies of water sort of protecting us from the rest of the world. And that's unique.
Yeah. And really important before the era of airplanes in warfare, right? Mm-hmm. But one thing I guess that we should name as we begin this conversation is to recognize, in one sense, we are an occupied nation from the indigenous point of view. This is indigenous land that the United States actually occupies. So we are, in a sense, an occupier, many of us, most of us that live here today. So naming that as an important sort of backdrop to our conversation. One occasion in which the United States was occupied, of course, is relatively soon after the Revolutionary War, in the War of 1812, when our capital city, Washington, D.C., was occupied and burned by the British during the war. A more important over the long haul, perhaps, occupation would be the Union's occupation of the southern states following the Civil War. And that one was really a result of southern intransigence. Initially, the post-Civil War notion of reconstruction, putting the nation back together, was fairly lenient on the Confederate states. The presidential reconstruction really asked very little of the southern states. As a result, though, we saw immediately an attempt to re-enslave the black people of the southern states through black codes and a series of other actions. And that resulted then in an election in 1866 that was a massive triumph for those who wanted a more serious reconstruction of the South that led then to five military districts that would exist from then until all the way through to 1877 and the end of the Reconstruction era. That occupation ends actually in a kind of a, it gets called the Compromise of 1877, but you have to think about who was at the table. What it was really was a selling out of the cause of the protection of black rights on behalf of the Republicans in order to retain the presidency in a contested election. But Bruce, there's some other examples that are like occupation, but not of the nation by an external force.
Sure. And you look at the concept of martial law, in which, you know, a government, either a state government or the national government, actually occupies with military forces an area. And we don't think of it. We think of martial law often as, well, suppressing a rebellion or something like that. But martial law also is often declared in disasters. So the Chicago Fire, 1871, martial law to keep the city sort of peaceful and allow it to rebuild. The same thing after the Galveston hurricane in 1900 and the San Francisco earthquake in 1906 and the Evansville flood in 1937. I mean, all instances in which major disasters sort of wiped out cities. And so to prevent any kind of chaos and to provide stability for the rebuilding process, martial law is declared. You also get it in insurrections, not in our most recent insurrection in January 6th, but the Door Rebellion in Rhode Island in 1842, where you had in Rhode Island, essentially, still by the 1840s, still had its original colonial sort of charter in effect, which limited voting rights only to people who were white and owned property. And there was big pushback against that. And so essentially a new constitution was written, and you had two contesting governments in Rhode Island. And so for a bit of time, martial law was declared to sort of suppress that. You also get it around the Mormon movement west with Nauvoo in Illinois and what's often called the Mormon War in 1843. Martial law was declared. And then later in Utah, as Mormons begin to settle Utah in 1847, martial law is declared. So you do get it occasionally, but mostly it's not about insurrections as much as it's about, you know, keeping the peace after a national disaster. Okay. You know, we've been talking about martial law, and it might be good to just step back a minute and sort of remind ourselves and our listeners what martial law really is. It's essentially the ability at either the federal or the state level to suspend all rights, to suspend the Constitution, to suspend normal sort of police and court procedures, and have a military government at work. And that doesn't occur very often, but when it does, it's often as a result of a real need to establish order, at least in the eyes of those in power.
And of course, there's other times when military forces are used inside the United States, federal forces or state forces, but without the declaration of a full martial law situation. We see this again and again, of course, with the response by the corporations to early labor activism. And these sometimes are very, very bloody confrontations. The first one that comes to mind for me is always the Homestead Strike in 1892 at the Carnegie Steel Works, because Carnegie, of course, leaves the country and leaves the situation in the hands of Frick, who immediately employs Pinkerton agents, as well as the state militia, and ultimately federal troops are involved. In these cases, sometimes federal troops are a bit of a relief because it prevents the sort of open violence that's taking place. But those federal troops are always at the behest of the owners of these businesses and in opposition to the creation of powerful labor unions. And we see that again and again and again in Coeur d'Alene in 1892, where it's largely private police. The Colorado Coalfield War in 1913 and 1914, one of the bloodiest in our history that led to the Ludlow Massacre. And that involved both federal troops and privately employed troops. And this happens again and again in the coal fields and in the oil fields. One of the most interesting for me is the Minneapolis General Strike in 1934, where they declare martial law, but it actually ends up being a victory for the organizing of labor unions. And unions are really allowed to organize in that city in the aftermath of that general strike, even as they, in a sense, quote, lost the strike, but they won the war. In other cases, federal troops have been used to protect those who are attempting to make change in the country, sort of in the opposite kind of story from that I just named with labor. Think of Little Rock, Arkansas in 1957, when those nine black high schoolers are going to go and enter Little Rock Central High School. The state police are a complete failure. They ask the National Guard to help, and until they're actually federalized, and then the 101st Airborne is brought in, it's impossible to have those children safely at high school. Now, that year was never a piece of cake, but the arrival of those federal troops made possible their enrollment and the graduation of one of those Little Rock Nine. Similarly, the Freedom Rides in 1961. Again, there are Supreme Court decisions that make clear that interstate buses, as well as the restaurants and waiting rooms, are all to be desegregated, but that's not happening in the southern states. So a group of activists, you know, start to ride the buses, and they are violently attacked in Anniston, in Birmingham, and in Montgomery, Alabama. And it takes the arrival of a federal agreement with President Kennedy for those riders to make it safely through to Jackson. Now, as part of that, remember, those riders were then immediately arrested by local police, also part of the agreement, and they spend time at Parchment Prison in Mississippi.
Yeah. In one of the interesting aspects of that, in Alabama, the governor actually declares martial law in the state to prevent the Freedom Riders from coming in because they would be a disruptive influence. So martial law depends on who's in power and who's declaring martial law.
Yeah. And what they consider the meaning of order. Is order no disturbance, or is order justice and the following of the Constitution? And those are contested questions, as we've talked about in other episodes, right? Another place that you sometimes see federal troops used, or state troops, is against protest, having to do with more political issues. The Bonus Marchers in 1932, one of the really tragic examples, right? These are fellows who had served in World War I. And at home during the war, a lot of people see raised wages and are really making good money during the war. Those who were serving were being paid far less. And so at the end of the war, the federal government makes an agreement that they would pay those soldiers later on a bonus for their service. Well, when that depression hits in 1929, those veterans need the cash. And in 1932, they organize and begin a march to Washington, D.C. It begins actually from cities all over the country, but with its origins in Oregon, south of us. They come to the federal government. They camp out across the river from the Capitol. They gain no access. They gain no agreement. And ultimately, they're forced out by troops on horseback and with great violence. And their encampment is burned to the ground. And again, these are federal troops being used against our own veterans. In the midst of the terrible Great Depression. And then another example that's really important for me is during the war in Vietnam, we see what people are familiar with, the shooting of four students who died, as well as six others on the Kent State campus, following 3 days of activism, some, you know, really misbehavior in the city, breaking of windows. Unfortunately, the National Guard did not handle themselves well that day. That Monday, the students were in retreat. They had no weapons, and they opened fire on those young people, tragically. Another case that happened 10 days later that's relatively unknown involves state police on the Jackson State campus, where two kids are killed and 12 others wounded. Again, these students aren't even protesting. There had been a protest, but these kids are just hanging out. Suggests the difference between what happens on a black college campus, Jackson State, and a white police force. It wasn't really about the war in Vietnam, though it's often seen that way. Kent State's the one that we tend to remember, again, because it's the first time we see troops firing on white college students. It wasn't the first time the black college students had been shot.
And you also get other instances where the government has intervened to incarcerate citizens without any kind of cause or legal process. And of course, the most striking example of that is the Japanese-American incarceration during World War II, which took place here on Vashon Island, as well as all along what was called the exclusion zone of the West Coast. Japanese-Americans, over half of those incarcerated are American citizens. They're not charged with any crime. There's no sort of real cause other than sort of inherent racism and sort of fear of Japanese growing economic power. And so all along the West Coast, Japanese are sent to what are euphemistically called internment camps. They're really prison camps. Franklin D. Roosevelt calls them the American concentration camps. So you have right here on Vashon the incarceration of Japanese Americans. Again, without cause, without legal process, but not really martial law.
Yeah. And in fact, when it happens here on Vashon, it's not that they're incarcerated here, but this 117,000 people are actually removed from their homes, huge loss of property, and sent to those concentration camps inland.
So if I may jump in here, it's amazing what the examples we're finding that are reminiscent of the Philadelphia occupation. Let's look at current events. Bruce?
Well, of course you have COVID, which is still fresh in most of our minds, 2020, where the government steps in, and it's not really an occupation. And it's not really the imposition of martial law, but it's an imposition, if you will, or a sort of a protocol set up about masking, about contacts, about vaccinations, that just creates an incredible pushback among the American people. I think as we look in the future, as we look back on the COVID epidemic, we're going to see that much of the political turmoil we see in the mid-2020s is a result of that sort of what many people see as government overreach during the COVID crisis.
Well, and since we have in our presence here the writer of a book about the pandemic from 100 years ago, maybe you'll do a follow-up.
Maybe so. You never know what could happen. Another example for me that's really striking is the January 6th insurrection, which is really an attempt to occupy, right, our Capitol building by people who were not, you know, members of the United States military or the Washington, D.C. police, but in fact were attacking them. So an attack from within with the attempt at a kind of insurrection, a kind of occupation.
And you also see that same kind of thing going on right now with the No Kings Day kinds of protests, not really occupations, but people coming out in the hundreds of thousands, even in the millions around the country, to sort of make their dissatisfactions known. And what we've seen so far is a relatively subdued response by authorities, both state and federal authorities and local authorities. And the real question is, as we continue into 2026 and 2027, as we move toward the 2028 election, will that federal, state, and local response remain subdued, or will it become more and more of an imposition of political power?
And one worries that the ICE raids gives us a foreshadowing of what could happen when we saw, you know, no court warrants, the ICE officials wearing masks, covering their identification, and really just defying what are understood as police practice, you know, best practices, and really enacting a much more sort of heavy assault, in a sense, on folks that seemed really unwarranted, leading, of course, to the deaths not just of Renee Good and Alex Preddy, but several other people as well.
And then if we jump ahead to Vashon history, we have our own, not nearly as dramatic, but certainly our own important things that happened. Bruce, you're always the expert on this.
Vashon has never really been occupied, if you will, except for if you consider the Shuap's people who were here for a millennium, who were then forced off the island, very reminiscent of what happened to the Japanese during World War II, during the Puget Sound Treaty War. The native people of central Puget Sound are rounded up. They're incarcerated on Fox Island. And then they're basically moved from there to reservations, you know, mainly the Puyallup and the Nisqually Reservation. And so what you have is an effect, an occupation by the territorial government of Washington of, you know, central Puget Sound and removing the people who were here already. So in one sense, Vashon begins, modern Vashon history, non-native Vashon history, begins with an occupation. But then you also have the fact that Vashon has always been a hinterland, a kind of a vassal state, in my mind, to King County.
That's a good description.
We've never had our own government. We've never had our own ability to control our own destiny, except through King County Council, through the legislature of the state of Washington, and through the federal government in the other Washington. So Vashon has always been sort of at the mercy of outside forces. You could view that as an occupation, and at times many Vashon Islanders have seen it that way. And that's why, you know, over the last 120-plus years, we've had 8 attempts for King County, for Vashon to break away from King County and to form either their own county, their own government, or to incorporate as a city, none of which was successful, but all which represent that sense of Vashon feeling like they're occupied by an outside force or by a government that they don't control. You also have, I think, just to me, one of the fascinating examples of kind of an occupation occurs in 1939. At that time, the ferries on Puget Sound are controlled by the Black Ball Fleet, so it's a monopoly of ferries all over Puget Sound. And there'd been a number of strikes coming, ferry strikes coming along. And so Vashon had heard of a strike going to be called the next day. So a group of Vashon Islanders go to the north end, go onto the ferry Elwha, which then takes them over to Southworth, and they sit down on the ferry and refuse to leave. And I think they get the inspiration from the sit-down strikes in the auto industry in the few years before that. And so in a very Vashon Island way, the next morning the sheriff comes along and says, "Well, you guys really can't be here. Would you leave?" And they said, "Of course we'll leave." And so they so they take off and leave. But a one-day occupation of the ferry Elwha to prevent it from not coming back to Vashon if there was a strike. You also, and we talked about this a little bit earlier, you have the incarceration of Vashon Japanese Americans during World War II. And Vashon has not been occupied by military forces, but we've had military on the island in a number of cases. The very first time that military are stationed on Vashon is during World War II, and they're stationed at what was then the center school right near where the high school was. That became the military headquarters for a small group of soldiers, sort of U.S. Army soldiers stationed on Vashon during the war. Then right after the war, the beginning of the Cold War, you have the introduction of Charlie Battery, an anti-aircraft battery. And if you know the Eagles Club, that was actually the dining hall for Charlie Battery. And the fear was that it might actually fire the guns at some point. I've talked to people at Beale Greenhouses. They thought if those guns were fired, every piece of glass in these greenhouses would shatter. And then, of course, we have the Nike base at Sunrise Ridge and Paradise Ridge. And we have, of course, the creation of a vigilante force, a sort of auxiliary sheriff force, during the 1970 Memorial Day rock concert in Paradise Valley. So Vashon has been isolated from occupation, but we see echoes of it all through Vashon history.
And all of it began with Philadelphia. So thank you for joining us. Join us next time, when we'll be joined by constitutional scholar Craig Bellis and discuss the Articles of Confederation, the first attempt to form an American government and the first iteration of the U.S. Constitution. Thanks to Nancy. Thanks to Bruce. We'll see you next time.
That's a wrap to this episode. Bruce and I invite you to join us again each week through the end of 2026 for interesting stories about our collective American and Vashon Island history. If you have a question, comment, or suggestions of a topic we might want to cover, please drop an email to vashon250@voiceofvashon.org. Vashon 250 is a production of Voice of Vashon and the Vashon Heritage Museum. Our producer is Truman O'Brien. Vashon 250 is sponsored by NACM Business Credit Services, a 126-year-old association focused on credit education and professional financial services for business credit departments across the nation. For more information, go to nacmbcs.org. We appreciate their support. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.